Paranormal, UFOs, monsters, mysteries. You're listening to Talking Weird. And now, from a cabin deep in the Northwoods, your hosts, Dr. Dean Bertram and Jen Durrell.
Welcome, all my weirdos and weirdettes, to Talking Weird on the Untold Radio Network. I'm your host, Dean Bertram, and I'm delighted that you could join us for this episode. I am very, very excited about the guest that we're having join us tonight. I've been meaning to get him on this show since it started. He's from my home country, Australia. He's an environmental consultant, a radio broadcaster, a teacher, author, and International Athena Foundation Earth Champion. He is the author of Australian Cryptozoology, which I only just read, to be honest. I should have read it. It's been out, I think, for a little while. You can get it on Kindle. It's a great book. I read it just today, just jam-packed with fantastic information about Australian cryptids and the like, and written in a very balanced, very articulate, very readable way. And he also wrote Understanding Humans and Extraterrestrials, which I haven't read yet, but I'm going to have to read that shortly. He's appeared on several US, Australian, Canadian, and UK documentaries and podcasts. You've probably seen him on a number of them. I know I have. He's been interviewed as an expert on Yowies, which is Australia's own Bigfoot-like cryptid, thylacines and great goannas, among other creatures. These programs have included Doug Hijacks, who, of course, is the founder and head of the Untold Radio Network. He's a fantastic show, Monster Quest, as well as Finding Bigfoot and Boogeyman, all fantastic shows. He's a frequent presenter at Australia's classic Nexus magazine conferences. They're great. I've been to some of them myself, and various other Australian cons. He's an environmental consultant with a field research and public relations career spanning 55 years. He's lectured on botany, zoology, geography, ecology, permaculture, and I could go on and on and on. This man is an expert on multiple things. He truly is a polymath. He's also the wildlife expert environmental consultant for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, North Coast New South Wales Radio on 94.5 FM. And he has a weekly talkback radio broadcast at 6:40 a.m. every Saturday morning, which has been broadcasting since February 1997. So I'm delighted to welcome to Talking Weird a long overdue guest, Gary Opert. Greetings, Gary.
Hello, Dean.
It's wonderful to have you here. I've been meaning to have you on the show for so long, so I finally got you here.
Yes, so here I am in the Great Southland, the land down under, Australia, and of course I'm broadcasting from the easternmost point in Australia, which is in northeastern New South Wales, Byron Bay, and we're in the traditional lands of the Bundjalung, Aboriginal First Nation people who have existed on this continent for something maybe 80 to 100,000 years. And the names of most of our cryptozoological animals as yet unclassified by science, generally have indigenous, Aboriginal or First Nation names.
You know, before we jump into Yowie stuff, which I was about to do, that is a point you make in your book regarding the Aboriginal traditional residents of Australia. You make the very interesting point that their myth cycle system, the dreaming, has all these interesting connections to modern ideas in quantum physics. Could you talk a little bit about that? I found that fascinating. I didn't expect to find that in the book, to be honest.
Yes, and look, the dreaming is the true Australian mind or consciousness. It's the First Nations description of reality, and it's spot on as it accords with modern physics, quantum mechanics, etc., and that's the fact that, and which we know, though few people take notice of, that we're not the solid entities that we think we are. You can see my surface area, but you and I, of course, all the important parts are inside. If you could see us as we really are, you'd be amazed, because we're constructed out of all of these organisms. And as well as that, we're electromagnetic entities, because we, as quantum mechanics teaches us, the only thing that exists in the universe is movement, is energy, straight line energy, which comes from stars and ourselves, heat and light, and this spiraling or circular energy, which is the atomic structures, and where they interact, they create modern reality, or they create right reality or consciousness. So, and so the universe consists entirely out of communication, and here we are communicating. There's no such thing. There's no other thing but communication. The universe is constructed entirely out of data or information, and everything else is a delusion, but an essential delusion so that we can survive. And the indigenous people understand that, and they understand that we are not walking around on a landscape. We are part of the living landscape. And as we know, there's only a single living entity in the known universe, and that's the surface of our planet, which is a single living entity that's absorbing energy from the sun and photosynthesizing with plants and the animals and fungi, recycle everything. And that's the only reason we exist. That's the reason we're talking at the moment. And so the Indigenous Australian people, they always say, you know, as they used to say years ago in the conservation movement, Earth first. We have to take care of the environment, because we are the environment. And as we know, if you live in a degraded, hostile environment, you yourself will be degraded and hostile. You can't be any possible other way. If you live in a serene and sane and healthy environment, you'll be healthy as well. And so all of the mental problems that beset modern humanity all come from a failure to understand that we are the environment. The environment must always come first, because the environment gives us the air to breathe and gives us the food to eat. And the other important thing is that we're a community. There is only communities. I'm a community of microorganisms, as you are, and every other animal and plant on the planet is. And all of these communities are communicating with each other. And there's no such thing really as independent thought, because I know that the community taught me to think. They taught me to read and write. And anything that I'm talking about today, I didn't make it up or discover it. The community of scientists and intelligent people and philosophers and everybody else, most important, are the trash collectors and garbage collectors and sewerage operators. You know, I wouldn't be able to survive if the farmers, everyone else, were a big community. So there's no really such thing as independent thought. In a way, what we're doing is community thought, and here we are doing it right this moment. We're a community, a global community, and we're communicating, and we're just communicating the community's consciousness. We cannot think beyond the community. A community consciousness is the only thing that exists. But, of course, it gets highly distorted and delusional, as we can see in parts of the world, tragically, where people begin to regard themselves as enemies or what have you, where, in fact, we're all extremely close, interacting individuals, and we have to survive, because the universe is a very violent, deadly place, and the only place in the known universe where there's any stable environment and any consciousness is right here. So the rarest thing in the universe is ourselves, and we are the aliens to every other potentially occurring life form throughout the universe. A living planet are probably the rarest thing on Earth. So if there's any extraterrestrials listening on, they're seeing is too weird, the two bizarre aliens at the moment on this particular little screen that exists at the end of the universe. But and the Indigenous people, the Bundjalung people, another First Nation people of Australia, have a very profound understanding of reality, which is referred to as the dreaming. And so in the dreaming, you can think of that, you either have you either sleep, you're awake or asleep. You know, when you dream, when you're asleep, you're either in a state of no dreaming or dreaming. So instead of dreaming is like consciousness. And so it's a beautiful term. And the dream time, consciousness over time, beautiful terms. And in Australia, thankfully, after about 235 years, the Indigenous people are finally being respected, and an understanding of their fabulous culture is finally being accepted.
That always makes me think, that idea of the dreaming makes me think. I think it's the Poe quote, which is something along the lines of, how do I know that all they see or seem is not but a dream within a dream? And that feeds into something you very graciously suggested we should mention. And that's your colleagues, Tony Healy and Paul Cropper's The Yowie Files book, which has dropped recently, because I haven't read that book yet, but I've read some reviews. And my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you're probably more familiar with the book, is that this is a more metaphysical or paranormal type view, perhaps, of the entity or the creature that's the Yowie, the suggestion that this thing might be not just a simple physical cryptid, but might be something more complicated on a different spiritual or metaphysical level.
Yeah, look, it's very difficult to say. Remember that we're all investigators in one way or another, and I particularly investigate unclassified animals, and I only do that because I've encountered them myself and because I've spent my life working in wildlife parks working as an environmental consultant undertaking fauna and flora surveys and ecological assessments as part of development applications that go before councils and things like that. And I got that work simply because there's very few people that are able to identify native plants and animals. And that's what I do with my radio show, which has been going on continuously 27 years. People phone me up and they play a sound I did last week. The actual host, Angela Caterns, on the radio, she played this very strange call that she recorded on a phone from a veranda at night. And of course, it was a female fox. They have a very strange, it's not really a bark, it's a very bizarre call. And it's very unsettling when you hear it. But it's an introduced animal. We don't have native foxes. We have native carnivorous marsupials. And just a couple of words about Australia. American viewers, Australia is about the size of the United States, but as an island. So it's got coast all around it with beaches, and it sits between Antarctica and Indonesia. And the top third of it's tropical, and it includes vast areas of tropical rainforest and woodlands, some of the largest undisturbed wildernesses on Earth. Then the central third is sort of subtropical and temperate down towards the bottom, and Tasmania and New Guinea are two large islands south and north of Australia. And Australia's never been connected to Southeast Asia, so we do not have any Eurasian animals. So we have no squirrels or monkeys or apes or big cats or deer, elephants, rhinos, all of those animals. Our animals and plants are related to South America, because Australia was connected to Antarctica, South America, when it was a part of Gondwana. Africa, India and Madagascar were once part as well, but they broke away earlier. And so for about 50 million years, Australia has been moving north at a speed of 6 centimetres a year, heading towards Southeast Asia. And so the only animals that exist in Australia, native to the continent, have been here for many millions of years, come from South America, the marsupials, or Gondwana. South America is part of Gondwana. The incredibly ancient monotremes, the platypus, and the echidna, which are egg-laying mammals. And then, of course, we have some mammals that got across from Southeast Asia, basically bats and rats that came across millions of years ago floating on logs or flying. So we've got many species of native rodents, but we have no native deer or native big cats or native apes. However, the British, when they settled Australia about 235 years, anyway, a long time ago now, 235 years ago, I think, 1788, they first arrived in Sydney Heads, the first fleet, and then over time they introduced a whole lot of feral animals. So I've got a lot of feral animals in this country, including numerous species of deer, water buffalo, wild cattle, wild horses, wild goats, wild pigs, foxes, and rabbits, all introduced. But the native Australian animals live amongst these exotic species. So that's a little rundown on the Australian ecosystem. And that's why an animal like the Yowie, majority of zoologists would refuse to believe such a thing could exist, because it's part of the Asian fauna, say, if it's, you know, Gigantopithecus or something related to gorillas or orangutans or something. But however, it could be a native animal, because Australia, and not many people know this from that live overseas, of course, away from Australia, but Australia up until maybe 30,000 years ago or so was dominated by giant marsupials, giant birds, giant reptiles, marsupial lions, giant tortoises, and a number of species that have since gone extinct. And so some of these animals that have been seen, such as Yowies, there's also the possibility that they're remnant megafauna, which is a lot more acceptable to say some zoologists than a species that's got across from Southeast Asia. So that's a little potted history of Australia.
And you suggest in the book that the bunyip, which I'd get you to explain for listeners who don't understand what that is, but you suggest that the bunyip might be some type of megafauna, which is evolved to suit its current circumstances.
So the bunyip was one of the earliest discoveries or encounters by the first British settlers in Sydney, and then began to explore. And in 1912, the first report of a sea-like animal with a very loud voice lived in a lake to the south of Sydney. And then as explorers moved through Australia and European settlers began to take up land, the indigenous people, the First Nation people, warned them that there was a dangerous animal that could sometimes be seen in the rivers and lakes, and that it had a loud call, and that it was carnivorous, and it was about 3 meters long, covered in very sleek hair, dark brown glossy hair. It was obviously an aquatic animal, and they warned people that it was dangerous to, say, wash if you've been eating, say, roast duck or something. If you've just recently shot a duck, don't go washing your hands in the lagoons and rivers, because it could attract one of these bunyips. And of course, there was many different names for these animals, and these animals were regularly encountered, reports were made and published in local regional newspapers. And so the Australian community at the during the 18th century regularly ran reports of these bunyips. However, nothing was ever captured, and the animals were incredibly cryptic. Mm. So they appeared to be more like a giant marsupial otter, because they were described, and they were seen on the even in Melbourne in Victoria. They were quite common. They lived right along the Murray-Darling River all the way up to Queensland, and they occasionally roared, but they're very rarely seen, and they would sunbake on logs hanging over the water, but at the slightest disturbance they would dive into the water, and they would display by splashing water up into the area, 2, 3, 4 meters, 12 feet they describe again and again. But most of these actual descriptions have only recently come to light because our Australian National Library has an internet site called Trove, T-R-O-V-U.
It's great. And people should check out Trove. I only found it out recently. It's such a great site. Yeah.
And so you just have to put in Bunyip, say, and you get all of these reports from regional newspapers that have never seen the light of day, in a 100 years or so, because the big city newspapers stopped taking reports of these unknown animals. But there was two different kinds of bunyip. So there was the river bunyip or lake bunyip, which was a big otter-like animal, and it must have been an animal. We don't know anything about it all. There's no skeletal remains of it all. There's no fossil remains of it. It seemed to be always very rare and solitary. And it was, if ever it was seen on the surface or on the land. It was known to come out on the land, and there's even the odd reports of them chasing the odd person. But that seems to be more to, chase an intruder out of the territory, and then they disappear. And they lived in reed beds in particular, and also described living in hollow logs, but no. Bodies were obtained. It was always an incredibly rare animal, and I don't think there's been any reports of it since about the 1970s. However, most people won't report something that unusual they've seen like that. Scientists of the day thought they must be seals migrating up rivers, but it's highly unlikely that seals adapted for a lifestyle in the ocean, and the most important thing in every animal's life is the reproduction season, when they're carving out their territory on the beaches, and so the last thing they're going to do is be exploring thousands of kilometres upriver. So there's also a possibility with some species of a native freshwater seal. But the identity of the bunyip is still unknown. And the other bunyip that existed was the mountain bunyip, and also known as the native gorilla or the hairy man or the yowie. And there's many other sightings, reports and indigenous names for them. And the yowie has been incredibly successful, so the reports are still coming in, even though there's no physical evidence of their existence, but they're very much like your North American Bigfoot or Sasquatch.
That's why that book I mentioned before from your colleagues, Tom Healy and Paul Cropper, I have to read it, The Yowie Files. It reminds me of work here from people like Joshua Cutchin and Timothy Renner, who look at Bigfoot reports and various stories going back to, Native American times up until the present, that these things often behave more like almost something out of fairy faith or something which is paraphysical. Their book, Where the Footprints End, is literally, it's kind of, I suppose the very title suggests that sometimes you'll find these tracks just leading into a field or something, and boom, they stop in the middle of nowhere. So there's all these things which suggest a paraphysical nature, as do some of the native traditions. I know a lot of American native traditions suggest that these things have a more spirit. They have a physical component, but they also have a spiritual component.
Yes. Look, the only way we're really going to find out is if we can get DNA, and these days the sciences have increased to such a degree that now in Australia and perhaps in the rest of the world, scientists can take a sample of water from the bushland or from a lake or simply from the air. And in that sample will be the DNA of every animal that lives in that bushland. So the only trouble is if the yowie is a close relative to people, so it's like a true hairy human, say a relict hominoid or hominin, as pioneering researchers Rex and Heather Gilroy believe that yowies are Homo erectus, surviving populations of Homo erectus, whereas other people think that they're a surviving population of Gigantopithecus, which is an Asian ape and only known from, you know, 500,000 years ago or something in Asia, and it's only known from a few teeth, etc., teeth and a jawbone. But the animals described as a, like an enormous gorilla-like animal. If there's no DNA available, it shows you that the animal doesn't exist. So maybe it does have a paranormal reality to it, but the paranormal reality is not an explanation, because in any field of investigation, you have to, your investigation has to make sense and has to correlate with every other possible kind of investigation. So as an example, if some crime has been committed, and the police come and investigate the crime scene, you've had a family member kidnapped, or you've something stolen or whatever, and the police were to investigate and look for DNA, and they say, look, I'm afraid there's no physical entity, there's no physical evidence whatsoever. We can't find any DNA. So we've come to the conclusion that the criminal came from another dimension. And that's our official report. And your reaction to that would be, what? Are you insane? What do you mean the criminal came from another dimension? Oh, I want this detective sacked, put on a real detective. And that's a trouble with cryptozoology. You can't really say, you can't really explain them away as, they come from another dimension, or they're parapsychical, or paranormal or something. Because those terms actually mean nothing. Like there's nothing behind them, you know. Like scientists, cosmologists, and physicists and stuff say, there could be up to 11 other dimensions, but there's nothing. There's no sign of anything leaking through from one dimension to another. And if such a thing could occur, what else would come through? And why would a big hairy thing like a gorilla come through into another dimension or another phase of reality? Wouldn't everything else come through, like all kinds of microbes and bacteria and everything? And it would be devastating for our ecosystem. Suddenly everyone would get a terrible disease. And imagine the yowie does come from another dimension. And it's a hairy animal, looks like a gorilla, acts like a gorilla or a Gigantopithecus or a Homo erectus or something. And we know that every animal on Earth is covered in microbes and parasites. And, in fact, every animal on Earth needs microbes in its gut to digest its food. So a cow can't digest grass without the microbes in its gut, and we can't digest our food without microbes in the gut. So if a thing like a gorilla is able to slip through from one dimension to another, well, how about the microbes that infest it and the parasites and what have you? And theoretically, you could get a plague of alien microbes coming through, unless, of course, it doesn't have any kind of solid reality and it's purely an optical illusion or whatever. But unfortunately, none of those explanations offer really any answers. They're sort of almost a cop out, you know. So it'd be just like the detective saying, we can't find any evidence, so he must have come from a different dimension. And nothing about it. So, because any form of investigation has to correlate with every other form of investigation. You know, so if you're looking for one thing, you can't have an explanation that can't be used for the investigation into anything else, no matter what it is. We don't really know. That's why this is such an interesting subject, because there's no other subject on Earth that is as interesting, besides maybe ufology, and most of that takes place up in the air where you can't get at the things, whatever they are up there, and you can explain them away as secret military advanced devices, and that they're nothing to do with extraterrestrials or outer space or whatever. But the cryptozoology is fascinating because it's the only situation where ordinary people encounter pretty ordinary animals, even if it looks like an escaped gorilla or looks like a Tasmanian tiger or a big black panther that shouldn't be there or something or other. the ordinary people encounter these ordinary animals in ordinary environments, like virtually in their backyards or in local bushland or forest, and there's no explanation for these animals. And there needs to be an explanation, because it could mean that we don't understand reality. Because, I mean, something's leaking through that we can't explain, and it's these anomalies that drive science. So, I mean, quantum mechanics was found was because we believed we knew exactly how the universe worked with classic physics, and then we discovered that there's a problem there. It doesn't work at all, and that the universe is not constructed out of clockwork matter. It's constructed out of energy movement, and so there must be, perhaps there's an aspect of reality that we don't understand at all. One of the things to remember, we can only see a tiny portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, which is light and heat, but we can't see infrared or ultraviolet, and some insects and other animals can see that. But that electromagnetic spectrum, that continues to infinity on either side. So we only can view a tiny aspect of reality. And also the other thing we've discovered is that the visible detectable universe only makes up 4% of reality. They believe that something like 95% of reality is composed of dark energy and dark matter, 4% dark matter, which is, well, we don't know what it is, except the evidence shows that it's there, but we can't detect it in any way. So maybe these cryptozoological sightings have something to do with dark energy and dark matter. But then how come they only portray themselves as scary-looking gorilla-like things in the bush and don't exhibit any other characteristics? And the other thing too is, why is it that these animals, if they do come from another dimension, I don't say they do or they don't, I just say I got no idea, why do they only appear in the natural habitat? Like you would think you'd bump into, if they come from another dimension, you could encounter them in the local supermarket or in your office on the 27th floor of a skyscraper, because if they come from another dimension, they could appear almost anywhere there. They could appear in your main street of your city, but they're always deep in the bush. So that's another problem with this paranormal explanation. It doesn't fit the whole scene, really.
I think you had some answers yourself to why that might work, though, and that is in the book and even now talking, the idea that the gap between us and the other, like in the dreaming, this reality and another dreaming might be, or another reality might be thinner than we think. And to use your police analogy, I love that analogy you brought up about, you know, how people would be like, you can't just explain a murder that it was, you know, some paranormal manifestation. But I have a similar analogy that I only used. I was chatting to somebody the other day, and the way ufology and cryptozoology and people who are interested in the paranormal and ghost hunting all operate reminds me of before the days there was any combined law enforcement overreach between different counties. Like if you had this police department over here looking at a killer and it didn't talk to this police department over here looking at evidence which was similar to another killer, to this one across county lines, you would never have found the patterns in serial killers. I think what we're seeing in the broader UFO, because I think the UFO thing's related. This is what I love about Talking Weird. I can have these kind of whacked out conversations. I think the UFO phenomenon is related to the cryptozoological phenomenon. It is related to the paranormal phenomenon. And that isn't just a wild hypothesis that I'm, I guess, plucking out of nowhere. It's because there are commonalities between many of these manifestations. The most obvious one is the lack of any physical evidence left behind. I mean, we can go down to comparing actually the way the phenomenon behaves, but the fact that none of these interests in the other, whether it's again UFOs or the paranormal or cryptids or whatever, there's never anything left. There's trace evidence in the way that we have footprints, or we might have, you know, a landing mark from a UFO, or we might have, you know, evidence that a ghost knocked something over, but there's never any lasting physical evidence. And you would think in one of these fields, particularly in cryptozoology, that there would be some body of a Sasquatch, or there would be some, you know, body of a dugong, not a dugong. We'll talk about dugongs in a minute, because that's something else you mentioned in relation to mermaids I found interesting. There'd be a body of a bunyip. There'd be something that would give us proof that these creatures were actually there. But it's the same as ufology and the paranormal. There's no physical evidence remaining that we can knock on the doors of the scientific institution and go, here you go, this is proof positive that we have one of these things.
Yes, there's another, the only other explanation that I can come up with, and that is, as I said, you know, our true reality is we're part of a larger organism, which is the living surface of the planet, and it's made up of all the different plants and animals, the ecosystems that absorb sunlight and recycle matter and energy. And so the living planet's a huge living organism. And, of course, we know that we've always lived as part of that living organism. And we also know that we're all basically we're consciousness. Everything's consciousness. Everything's communication. So perhaps not only is there a combined physical reality to our existence in that we're dependent upon the community of people and the community of animals and plants to exist, but perhaps there is a planetary mind in operation. And this planetary mind is known to actually exist to a degree, because they've found that the most conscious part of a plant, and plants are highly conscious, of course, is beneath the ground in their roots, where the bacteria of the and microbes of the plant cells interact with the fungus cells, different kinds of species of fungus, and they work together, and the trees actually feed one another and take care and send messages to each other. And so beneath the ground, in the roots of all the trees, in the forests in particular, there's this enormous mind in operation that we're completely deaf to and blind to. We can't even hardly imagine that such a thing could exist. And so that would mean that there must be a planetary mind that's been in operation for millions upon millions of years, underground for a start, under the roots of the forests, because originally the planet was almost completely covered in forests before the ice ages and what have you, tropical forests. This was really a tropical planet, and then of course, so the surface of the planet, all the animals and plants and the birds in the sky and everything else. And remember, the oxygen itself and the atmosphere is created by the plants and the animals. The clouds are created by marine organisms, by marine algae, and they produce ammonia that goes up into the that lifts the droplets of water vapor up into the air. So it's these amazing marine plants create the clouds that moderate the climate. Otherwise, the planet would be just getting too hot and too cold, and so life is totally in charge of the actual conditions of the planet, and it's all consciousness. And so perhaps there's an enormous conscious mind that includes our entire planetary global human mind and the planetary global plant and animal mind and fungal mind, etc. All is one single mind, which must exist, because we are all members of a communicating species living amongst other communicating species. And so maybe it's the planetary mind that's creating these images of flying saucers and aliens and unknown and unclassifiable animals. Though why it would do that is then a great mystery, but that's just another possibility, and another thing that has to be incorporated into trying to obtain answers as to why people are seeing things that can't be identified, and not simply shooting the messenger. Say, oh, I don't believe you for one second. You know, how could you have seen something I haven't seen? Yeah.
That's that planetary mind hypothesis is fascinating. Let's talk about some of your own experiences, because I'm sure our viewers and listeners would love to hear that. We'll hit the weirdest first. This is one that I, again, it wasn't something I was expecting in the book, and then maybe we'll go back to the Yowie before we finish. And that is, you saw something in Papua New Guinea, right, that was in many ways, its head popped up like a mermaid. And at first you thought maybe it was a dugong, and then you were like, no, that wouldn't have been a dugong.
Yeah, so that's right. So I spent a couple of years altogether in the tropical island of New Guinea. New Guinea is the largest tropical island on Earth, and it rises up to 16,000 feet, I believe. There's a glacier up there, and it's composed of an enormous range of high altitude mountains and volcanoes. And then it drops down to a fabulous a coral-encrusted coast. It's inhabited by the most fabulous Melanesian people that sort of probably distantly related to Australian First Nation people. Papua New Guinea is one of my favourite places. It's magnificent. I haven't been there since 78. And I spent a lot of time with a biologist from the WOW Ecology Institute, which is a field station of the Bishop Museum of Hawaii, and we're on expeditions climbing mountains that hadn't climbed before and discovering new birds of paradise species, etc. And then and the whole place is relatively, especially in those days, relatively undisturbed. And I spent a lot of time living with people that had never seen an outsider before, and they thought I was a ghost. And then they'd make me a member of the tribe, and they'd blacken me with charcoal and pig grease, and I'd be covered in bird of paradise feathers and with the other head people with my own bows and arrows and spears running through the jungle and joining in big ceremonies, all kinds of stuff. I've lived most of my life more in the wilderness than had very little to do with civilization. And so on this a coastal boat, so it's all rainforest right down to the water. In fact, we overlap the reef and the fringing reefs. And it's crystal clear water, alive with fish in those days. There was no fishing going on. And I was studying the wildlife, as I always have all my life. I was at the bow of the boat watching. And we're 3-4 kilometres, say a mile or two out off from shore. You can still see the shore. And this is along the north coast. We were travelling between Lae and Wewak, along the north coast, and I saw this round head on the surface of the water, which looked just like a human head, a dark brown human head. And I thought, oh, was that a fisherman, or why would there be somebody? But that they only had the indigenous New Guinea people only had wonderful outrigger canoes cut out of fallen, cut out of a big tree, rainforest tree, and they'd go out quite a ways. And I thought it might be a chap swimming fishing or something. I looked around, there was no sign of a boat anywhere, and we were rapidly approaching this round head. It was perfectly round. And then I was surprised it suddenly ducked below the surface, and I went straight down. It didn't dive down like a dolphin or a dugong or anything. It just descended, and then the boat went right over it, and I was able to look down onto it, and the water was crystal clear, and it was descending tail first, and the whole animal was brown, and seemed to have a dolphin-like tail and an elongated body. I mean, just like a dugong or a dolphin or something, except it was going down vertically, and I could see the sort of round head. But of course, looking through the surface of the water, even though it was relatively calm, you couldn't see any detail. Anyway, I could only surmise it must have been a dugong. Or we have another animal called the Irrawaddy dolphin, or short fin dolphin, which has only a very small dorsal fin and a head and a bit of a neck, and not much of a snout like, say, your normal bottlenose dolphin. And so I thought probably one of those two species, because I didn't believe for one second in mermaids or anything. And then when I got to shore, I was always talking and I learnt the local language, Pidgin, and I was always asked the locals, because we were doing fauna surveys, what animals they'd seen, and particularly interested in what rare animals they'd seen. And this one elderly New Guinean man told me how they were fishing once, and they caught in the net a big animal, and they pulled it to the surface, and they were shocked, and they described a mermaid to me, but brown with big eyes, but a human face, and a female with breasts. And I said, oh, that's a dugong. That's a dugong. And he goes, oh, no, 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 we eat dugongs. We call them pig of the sea. No, no, no. This was what we call a interesting. They call it a mermaid. They call it a sea Mary. In the Pidgin, the word for woman is Mary, probably from the missionaries. And so they use the word Mary, and he said, no, that's a sea Mary. They said, you know all about them, sort of thing, because we've seen them on tins of sardines or something, and it shows you a mermaid or something. And I was astounded, like, oh, my God, I've picked up a report of a mermaid. You could tell I didn't believe him at first, and he began to get upset at me because I was saying, oh, no, you're not telling me the truth. You can't possibly see something like that. And so I was really amazed to get a report of a mermaid. And then the International Society of Cryptozoology had some expeditions into the area, and they were able to photograph the tail of an animal that they said marine scientists, biologists were never able to identify, and that the locals, this is in New Ireland, which I spent a bit of time on New Ireland, the locals knew the animal very well, said, oh, no, it's different to the dugong. This feeds on fish, and it looks very much like an aquatic person, but with a tail like a dolphin. I looked up other reports and found that similar reports had come from directly to the west of New Guinea in the Spice Islands, Indonesian Spice Islands, also describing a similar animal. It was an American pilot or military member who was living on an island. I can't remember if he was shot down or something or what he was doing, but he described the locals pulling up one of these animals and described it as looked, it was a true mermaid. And then the early accounts from hundreds of years ago when the Portuguese and the Dutch were exploring the Spice Islands just to the west of New Guinea, that's where other mermaid reports came from. So there's the very remote possibility that it's some species of, and probably critically endangered if it ever existed, but some species of a totally aquatic ape. Wow. And Bornean proboscis monkey have a very large nose, and they use and they actually swim in the sea to a degree. So yeah, I mean, I find, like, I'm a skeptic, of course, like most people, but I'm always fascinated by the possibilities. And if you think, oh no, that's impossible, well, we're semi-aquatic chimpanzees, because we know that something like 96.4% of our DNA is pure chimpanzee D of red, and that our blood is identical to chimpanzee DNA. So all those racists out there or something or other, we're all chimps. We're not even humans. And all of our features that make us human comes from being an ability to swim. And as we know, where do we like to go on holidays? Lie on the beach and go swimming, which we wouldn't do if we've never had anything to do with the beach. And it's one of the reasons why we're so upright, because if you swim, you can't be hunched over like a gorilla or orangutan. You have to be very straight. We have this is a hooded nose. That's for diving. If I didn't have that, I couldn't dive into the water. My face is covered in oil glands, which gives teenagers acne, and that's a waterproofing. So we've got a waterproof face, and our breathing tubes are reminiscent of dugongs. And we've got a layer of subcutaneous fat, which is the reason why we float. It's not to keep us warm, but because we float. So we're and our hair is puny. We've got as much hair as a chimp, only it's reduced. And what animals have reduced hairs? Only if you're a swimmer. And so it's been theorized that the genetics show us we all came from an individual or several individuals about 150,000 years ago, and there's theories that early Homo sapiens, which were a little bit bent over and not as large, quite as large brained as we are, and as flat faced and everything, perhaps populations of them were forced to or lived on islands. And did a lot of swimming and foraging. And, of course, one of the best places to live, as we know, is along the seacoast, where you can eat lots of easily obtainable mussels and crabs, and compared to the forest where there's all and you can, if a predator like a tiger or a lion arrives, you jump in the water, and if a shark arrives, you jump out of the water. So, you know, the beach is like our natural habitat in the Stone Age. And so we're sort of like semi-aquatic chimpanzees, which is why we look so different to the other animals, and why we think, oh, we're not animals, we're humans. In other words, we appear to be semi-aquatic chimpanzees. Others don't believe in that and believe that we obtained all these features simply by running around on the grasslands. And you think, well, no other animal that runs along on the ground on the grassland ended up with these features that are perfectly adapted for swimming. And so if you can have humans as semi-aquatic chimpanzees, maybe there was at one time fully aquatic chimpanzees, though, of course, there's no physical evidence for that. There's only a few odd sightings. But as we know, the world has been inhabited by fabulous animals, and you only have to look at documentaries and look at books and stuff on dinosaurs and prehistoric mammals and everything up until very recently, you know, mammoths and everything, giant sloths, everything imaginable. And so semi-aquatic chimpanzees can certainly fit in with everything from giant sloths to all the other astounding animals that cover the surface of the planet.
I think if I could choose any cryptid to be real, it would be a mermaid. If I could, what one's real, physically real? Mermaid. But speaking of other ones I'm interested in, I'm always fascinated with Bigfoot and Sasquatch and the Yeti and Australia's versions. Now, I know you've had some of your own sightings. Your book, by the way, is loaded with sightings and reports. It's so thorough. It's, again, people should check it out. We'll tell them how they can at the end of the episode. But can you tell us some of your own reports? I think your first hairy man report was in Papua New Guinea again, I think, right?
Yeah, yes. Well, the first thing, I was, as soon as I left high school, you know, I was working in a pet shop, and then I got jobs in a national park. I was a founding member of the conservation movement. I was a member of the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland, a founding member, etc. And I was working in the national parks up at Lamington. And if any of our American listeners come over to Australia, they're the most fantastic places in Australia, a place called the Gold Coast in northern New South Wales, because of the fabulous mountains behind, which is a 20 million year old volcanic caldera, with prehistoric rainforest, with trees that forests that have survived from the age of the dinosaurs, and there's fabulous. It's all protected in wonderful national parks. And I was a ranger, really a ganger. This is 1971. We're just called gangers. We work gangs basically, but we were rangers. And up in Lamington National Park, O'Reilly's, and one night something started thumping the side of the rangers' quarters, and one of the rangers went to the door, you know, saying, "Oh, what is it? What is it? Do you need help or something?" And he opened the door, and there was no one there. And then next thing, we could hear that something was under the house. So it was open under the house. The house is old, little timber house, three bedroom and an office and one large room, fuel stove. You know, we had no electricity. We had a thing. We had a little electric light. We had one electric cable or electric line coming to the house. But basically, it was very primitive, very remote, surrounded by wilderness. Hours of driving to get there through undisturbed wilderness at an elevation of about 3,000 feet, I think it is, or 1,000 meters, something like that, or 800 meters or something. And so the house was built on the edge of the rainforest. And the house sloped down at the back, so there was a second story underneath. There was nothing in it, and that's where we kept our tools. There was no light. We had no outside lights, and it was pitch black. And then whatever it was disappeared. And then the next day we went down. We found all the tools lying on the ground. We had to throw them back under the house. And then I went down to the wood heaps to get some wood because we wanted hot water. We had big piles of timber. We had to burn timber to get hot water. We had a fuel stove, which was a big cast iron stove. And the wood pile, we had a huge wood pile that was measured about, 6-7 feet long and a couple of 6 foot high, say, and 3 foot wide, around about 8 big stakes of timber about 6 feet long or more that we'd sledgehammered into the ground to contain this whole wood pile. And something had pulled all the stakes of wood out of the ground, which is a physical impossibility, and thrown all the wood around. And when I asked the O'Reillys, they said, oh, yeah, there's an animal we've never been able to identify. And Bernard O'Reilly writes in his book Green Mountains, which is the name of the area, that something used to follow him along the tracks in the daytime. And you'd go back looking to see what it was and never found what they were, but something would also roar or scream at them. No, they never identified it. Nothing then happened. I never found any sign of anything and was put down as being one of the mountain bunyips. Then when I was in New Guinea up at very high altitudes, I was working with a group of ornithologists. I was just a volunteer. They all had grants. They're all from America. I was the only Australian. This is 73, 74. And I was just helping out and paying my own way. But I just wanted to help out and also to watch the birds of paradise and all the fabulous animals spotlighting at night and identifying everything. We had entomologists and botanists and everyone. And when we're in this one locality at high altitudes, on several occasions, we had these incredible bellowing roars come from the forest. The largest animals there are cassowaries, which are giant flightless birds with horns on their heads, and tree kangaroos, and cuscusses, which are big possums, very distantly related to your American Virginia opossums, but look quite different, and also introduced wild pigs. But nothing could make these sounds, and it sounded very primate-like. It sounded more like the call of a primate. I used to follow it through the forest. I'd walk a kilometre or two through the primary undisturbed rainforest. In undisturbed rainforest, you can walk around on the ground because there's a heavy tree cover, and on the ground nothing but leaf litter and ferns and things like this, small shrubs scattered around, and there's quite a few large flightless giant pigeons, giant crowned Victoria crowned pigeons that are the size of turkeys with a big crest on their heads with white spots so that when they walk, they look like they've got a halo of stars on their head. Wow. And other species and megapodes, brush turkeys, etc. So I could never find out what gave these calls. We didn't hear them very often, very rarely. And then one time I was walking along a track. It was a logging track that had been put in, but no logging had occurred. And I saw a person come out through the forest onto the track in front of me, like a New Guinean, in that he was completely dark-skinned, not wearing any clothes. But I was too far away. I was probably about 600 feet from him or something or other. I had my binoculars with me. But I immediately took it was a person, definitely was a person. But unlike the New Guineans, They all wear some forms of clothing. In those days, they were traditionally dressed in. They create their own clothing out of bush strings. They always have bush string bags. They always have their bows and arrows. They always have an axe, a stone axe, or a steel axe. And they're always in groups. And they don't wander through the rainforest. They follow tracks because, you know, they're hunting. And so, it's easier to hunt along the track, say birds of paradise or other species or pigs or cassowaries or whatever. But this individual crossed the track, walked backwards and forwards, was looking down onto an ornithologist who was in a hide. And I was thinking, oh, it's someone to come. That's because we're in a very remote area where there was no people. I thought maybe my colleague had organised for someone to join us because this individual then went down. So, you know, I had a good view of this individual for, you know, a couple of minutes or something or other, trying to work out who is this. I had my binoculars, but I didn't sort of, it was before I could even think of putting the binoculars, because I just thought it was a person, but I couldn't understand why he wasn't carrying anything, why he was by himself. Why did he come out of the forest and cross the track? And he never looked up the track, so he never noticed me. And then he went down as if he was heading down to see the ornithologist. And when I got to the area, I had a perfect clear view looking slightly downhill. I said, oh, who was your friend? Who was that person? And he said, there's been nobody about. I haven't seen anybody. No, there hasn't been anybody. So whether that was the animal or the species or whatever that was calling, but we do know that the New Guineans and the Aboriginal people, they have a lot of about 4 or 5% DNA from this wonderful new species that we now call the Denisovan, which is a species of human, unrelated, distantly related to humans, but not closely related to humans, that's only known from a finger bone and some teeth, and I think also some more material maybe from the Himalayas, and they got a DNA analysis and they said it was related to Neanderthals distantly, but it was more ancient than Neanderthals, and in fact it was one of the candidates possibly for the Yeti. So it was lived in northern hemisphere, but it came down all the way to Australia, New Guinea, for people to interbreed with them. But when we talk about interbreeding, I mean, it mightn't have been a romantic situation. It might have been who knows what went on during the Stone Age. It's bad enough today, much less the Stone Age. So maybe this was the surviving Denisovans. Another species of human that are wandering around in the high altitudes, way above where the New Guineans themselves live. That was just another anomaly. You know, I saw that individual cross, and I got no evidence that it was real, or that I'm not making it up. But I was really surprised, and it was only afterwards I began to think about, oh, but that person wasn't carrying anything. Nobody. Nobody moves through high altitude rainforest not having anything in their hands, you know. and how could somebody be walking up there and high altitude Antarctic beach and Podocarpus rainforest and Clinky pine so that was. And then when I got back to Australia in 1975, I was near Springbrook. As usual, I was exploring by myself. I was always exploring the forest by myself, and I just identifying the plants and animals. That was always what I always did. It was my, if I had free time, I was always off in the bush bird watching and identifying the plants and animals. And something roared at me, with a powerful roaring voice that was as loud as a lion, but was nothing like a lion or any big cat. It was some other kind of animal altogether. And then also in about 69, I had a very close view of what may have been the marsupial lion Thylacoleocarnifex, this amazing animal crossed the road directly in front of me at about 11 o'clock at night. This is on the road between Brisbane and the Gold Coast when it was all forest and farms. Now it's all factories and civilization. Right. It was 9 though, and I was only a young fella with my first car driving at night. And this animal, amazing animal, crossed the road about the size of a leopard, with a big solid head that reminded me of a mastiff dog. And then the body came out covered in brindled hair, and then it had a long tail, long fluffy tail with dark bands on the tail, and the hind, and it wasn't worried, and there was virtually no traffic in those days, and I had to put the brake on so I didn't hit it, and so I was right up to it, and they had the lights on full beam. And it was unconcerned, and it just crossed the road directly in front of me. And the hind legs moved like a marsupial. You could see it was a marsupial, carnivorous marsupial, as big as a leopard, but a big head, not small head like a leopard, say. It had a big solid head. And the hindquarters moved like our brush-tailed possums and the marsupial lion. It's only known from fossils, dating the latest about 38,000 years ago, and it was a pouched carnivorous animal. It wasn't related to the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger. It's related to possums, and sure enough, it walked like a possum. And there's been a great number of reports of these, but all over the east coast of Australia, but particularly in Queensland, and it was mentioned in early scientific books as a true species. They're still trying to get a specimen, and it was known as the marsupial cat or marsupial tiger, because most individuals had distinct bands and a large head, and there's been a great many reports of that over the years, still coming in from undisturbed rainforest. And like the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger reports, and also the yowies, virtually all of these animals are carnivores. The yowie might be more omnivorous, but as we know, with any big powerful animal, predators in particular, they have big territories, and so like the Siberian tiger are hundreds of square kilometres of territory. And our carnivorous marsupials, like this spotted-tailed tiger cat or tiger quoll, which doesn't look anything like a cat. It looks more like a sort of a big ferret or a marten or a mongoose or something. It's a native pouched marsupial. Some individuals in poorer territory have a range, they say, of about 100 square kilometres. So with all of these predators, for one tiger, you might need 1,000 deer or antelope or something or other. They have all these predatory animals have large territories. And so if there are still marsupial lions and marsupial tigers or thylacines, et cetera, they'd be very hard to encounter because they're all ambush predators, so they know their entire environment, they know their territory, and the chance of you, and if they have a huge territory like 100 square kilometres, the chance of you ever encountering one is remote. And most of these reports, and I've received a great many during 27 years of radio shows, wildlife identification, so people would phone in to get wildlife identified, and 99% of them were always animals easily identified, but occasionally I'd get a report that couldn't be identified but always fitted into this other group of animals that I was getting reports of and that other researchers have been getting reports in and studying. And nearly all of these reports, the farmers in particular and foresters, national park rangers or bush regenerators, they generally only ever encounter one of these animals once in their life. Even though they've been on these farms for years, sometimes they'll get two or three reports over a 30-year period. And we also get black panther-like animals, which could be just a black phase of the marsupial lion, or it could be something else altogether, or they could be exotic animals. I had a report by a big cat specialist who's been all over the world studying big cats, and he saw a black panther in Victoria in daylight right beside his car, and he went to the police and told them, oh, black panther's escaped. And the police said, oh, we get reports of them all the time. We don't. What do you think? What can we do about it?
It's interesting that you mentioned how things like a potential thylacine would have such a great range as its natural predatory kind of movements. Because I know here in America, things like cougars or mountain lions or whatever you want to call it, they have various names. It's the same animal. They have great large ranges. Like you might get one passing through literally the Walmart parking lot 30 minutes from where I live had a cougar go through it, but it doesn't live there. It ranges. Do you know what I mean? It's got an incredible throw. So I've always thought of, I said before, my favorite cryptid, if it was real, would be a mermaid, probably followed closely by, I'd like a Bigfoot to be true. But I think the most likely of almost every cryptid I've ever, you know, hear about today, I do suspect that there really are thylacines still on, perhaps in Tasmania and also in mainland Australia. Are you still getting reports today on your radio show about thylacines?
See, what generally happens, I only receive reports if a report comes in and the news services take it up. And then I'll be flooded with reports, and then they'll go quiet again, because most people, and because everyone that sees these animals, they generally say, oh, you're the only person I've really talked to about these animals, because everyone else laughs at me. And as you know, if you saw something mysterious like a Bigfoot, and you go, oh, my God, I saw a Bigfoot in the back garden last night or something or other, everyone, you know, almost certainly everyone's going to laugh at you, because it's not something that commonly happens, and they're positive you're making it up. And the same thing with thylacines. Yeah, there's been reports nonstop. It's interesting that in Tasmania, the British had set up a settlement at Hobart, and it was 4 years before they saw their first thylacine, which they caught in a trap. They were very rarely ever seen or trapped. And when one was trapped, mainly by fur trappers, the whole island was covered. And it's a huge island. It's about 68,000 square meters, or am I talking about square kilometers or something? But yeah, yes. 68,000 square kilometres, I think it is. Tasmania, about one third of it is so wild, it's complete wilderness. It's a majority of the island's covered in forest. I myself don't receive many reports because I'm not in Tasmania, but there's some wonderful Facebook sites, the Thylacine Awareness Group, in particular, I know, because Neil Waters has been able to obtain some trail camera footage with images that look, you know, very, very much like a thylacine, though experts looking at it say, no, it's more likely a wallaby or something. especially if you're a biologist, you're forced to take a sort of sceptical opinion.
Right.
I would estimate that if thylacines still exist, and what you've got to remember that they were made out to be sheep killers, and a bounty was put on their heads, and people only began to obtain trap specimens of them, and they were exhibited in zoos all over the world, including Washington and London and in Europe and in all the Australian zoos, or most of them, and people were keeping them as pets. They're really marsupial dogs, and they were exhibited in dog shows, and you could buy a marsupial dog, also known as marsupial hyena or marsupial wolf, or Tasmanian tiger, because they've got a few stripes on their back, 10 or 12 or 15, 20 stripes. And they stand up like a kangaroo, and they were kept in captivity. And then they were hit by a disease, a mange-like disease, because the Australian marsupials are very much are very much susceptible to diseases, as all animals are. Like the First Nation people, both in Australia and North America, was devastated by the smallpox pig virus that they had no immunity to, and so the thylacine suddenly began to decline in the beginning of the 20th century. Though even before then, they were rarely seen. And remember that the studies of their jaws show that they've got slender jaws and they've got no strength in their jaws. The Tasmanian tigers had been mixed up in many people's minds with Tasmanian devils have very powerful jaws and they crunch through bones. But researchers studying the skulls of thylacines have stated that they've got very slender bones, that they couldn't grab an animal as big as a sheep, and that they only feed on little animals like bush rats and stuff, even though they're, say, large dog-sized or medium dog-sized. But I've picked up close to 100 reports of them over the last 30 years in southeastern Queensland, northeastern New South Wales in particular, going back to the 1960s when a logger or forestry worker had two really close views of one crossing the road. And then I had a fantastic report, one of my earliest reports from about 25, 30 years ago, where a group of banana workers on a banana plantation in northern New South Wales, Crabs Creek, and the chap that told me was a school teacher who was taking his school holidays, getting a bit of extra pay working as a banana. And as they were walking back down the slope, and it was a group of them, the owner's German Shepherd dog began to growl at a partly collapsed, overgrown with vines, banana packing shed. And he thought it was probably a feral cat. And he said, get him. And the dog charged into the shed and then immediately came backing out. And they were shocked to see this huge animal with his enormous wide jaws that was virtually almost as big as the German Shepherd dog, and it was giving forth with these really weird sounds and not barks or meows or anything. It definitely wasn't a dog or a cat, and it had stripes on its back. And the owner said, "Oh my God, it's a monster!" And he grabbed a stone and threw at it, and it suddenly realized there was a group of people standing there, and it ran uphill, and they all chased it uphill. And it ran into a big hollow log, and they were looking at it in the hollow log and going, "Oh, I'll have to bring a rifle back tomorrow. We can't have a monster living on the property." And because a lot of people, when they see one of these thylacines, they think, "Oh, someone's bred a dog with a kangaroo," because that's what they resemble. They can run like a dog and jump like a kangaroo. They've got big hindquarters and stripes on the back. So the next day they went up, but of course it was gone and they never saw it again. So I received many, many reports, and one was from a vet nurse at Suffolk Park in Byron Bay, near the edge of the property she owned or rented or whatever, was against the national park. And at 6 in the morning she heard this strange sound. It sounded like a brush-tailed possum, which goes sort of a strange sort of a coughing sound, which is exactly what a thylacine makes. So she went out and then she's gone, "Oh, my God, there's a dog attacking a cat." And she rushed up to it trying to shoo it away from a cat. So she's only within a meter of this animal. And then she realised, "Oh, my God, it's not a dog," and she's a vet. As you know, she had no dog-like characteristics, whatever. It was, she said, no doubt about it. It was a thylacine, a female thylacine, and she watched it for 5 minutes from 1 to 2 or 3 metres away before it turned around and disappeared back into the bush. So they're unaggressive animals, and I haven't had any recent reports of them, but if one was to come in and the newspapers took it up, I'd suddenly receive a whole bunch of reports, because people always don't bother. And there's a thylacine behind me. If I could just move out of the way. There it is. That's a thylacine behind me there. Yes. And that comes from the that's a tea towel from the federal government's Parliament House in the ACT Canberra. I got that, the thylacine. So it's a well-loved animal by Australians and some scientists, and say, oh, all these reports of thylacines that are received, it's because people feel guilty about, you know, how we hunted them to extinction. I think there's probably something like 300 individuals living in Tasmania, maybe only 150 or something, but just enough to be reproducing. And the thing with marsupials, unlike placentals, unlike animals like ourselves, the Australian marsupials have adapted to an incredibly resource-poor, nutrient-poor environment, because when the ice ages swept across the world, Australia was too far north from Antarctica to be affected. So while the rest of the world was particularly North America and Eurasia, of course, was covered by these huge ice sheets that came and went over 17 million years, ground all the rock into really fertile soil and created lakes everywhere. And that's why 360 million people can, say, live in the United States alone, because you've got such rich soils. And that's why the United States is such a powerful country, because you can't be powerful unless you have an enormous amount of agriculture to support the population and then be able to afford industries and everything. But Australia is the exact opposite. We never had glaciation, so we've got all kinds of spectacular rock formations, a bit like Western United States. They've got fabulous minerals, so the Australians are a very wealthy nation because of all the minerals that we've got. Our country is so nutrient poor, it's very poor in phosphorus, where many of the native plants, if you fertilize them, it would kill them. And the animals are adapted to that environment as well. So animals like koalas and stuff, they might only produce one young every couple of years. The koalas, for instance, feed on deadly poisonous eucalyptus leaves with very low nutrients. The animals are all adapted to a very nutrient-poor environment, and so they've developed all kinds of adaptations so that they don't waste energy. So, you know, koalas spend most of the day asleep, and people think, oh, I must be drunk on gum leaves or something. But they're conserving energy, and thylacines and marsupial lions, if they exist, all of these animals are well adapted to very nutrient-poor environments, so they're naturally inactive. They spend most of their time asleep. And as well as that, remember, all these Australian animals have coexisted with First Nation people who are the most wonderful conservationists and protected the environment very carefully because they relied on it for their survival. And so all of these animals, like thylacines, that live right across Australia and New Guinea, as well as Tasmania, they knew humans well, and thylacines have a very powerful sense of smell. And when they are kept as pets, they'd probably be tied up. And when the thylacine got very restless, the owners, the farmers, would know, oh, we better put the billy on because we're going to have visitors. Looks like the neighbours are on their way over. And 20 minutes later, the neighbours would arrive, you know, on their horse, a horse and cart or something,